Hi, this is Paul. I don't know how many of you caught that John Vervaeke was on Unbelievable with Justin Brierley, which I immediately clicked on it when I saw it, because John is not... I thought he was in... I could totally understand why Justin had him on the show, but John had to really shrink his argument down to fit it in, and I thought this was actually one of the best articulations of John's argument that I've heard. It could be that I'm just more and more familiar with it after talking with John and after working on John's stuff for quite a while. But for Justin's audience, which is sort of a radio program audience, to have John understood in that context is interesting. Now, his other guest was a bit more of who Justin usually has on the program. Now, overall, I thought that I didn't know how well the two conversations came together. I think John presented his body of work very well, and I thought the other individual too. Amari, I had never heard of him before, and since then I've read at least the samples of in Kindle of his two books. I didn't buy the books yet. I had a bad habit of buying books I don't finish, and so at least I start with the sample. But it was what I thought was interesting about the program was who these two people are and how they've come to their own positions. So what I'm going to do is actually sort of reverse the order between them, and we'll first sort of, I'll play a little clip of John and what I thought was a really nice, succinct explanation of his project, and then actually I gleaned some quotes from, you know, Amari's book. So I thought this was one of the best brief summaries of John's work that he's done, and it's just the way it is. The more venues you're in, the more you have to sort of distill it down, the better and better you get at sort of just putting it right there on the table. And I thought it was really tough for Amari to have much perspective on what John's been building in this little corner of the internet, and pretty tough on Justin too. Again, this was a pretty, you know, just thinking about it from Justin's chair, this was a pretty ambitious show to try to pull off in terms of bringing a broadly general audience into some kind of awareness of John's work. Again, I think Amari's work would have been more familiar for a lot of Justin's audience. Now, a lot of Unbelievable, there's a fair amount of people cheering for their home teams in Unbelievable. And that's not just Christians. It's also skeptics and atheists. And Justin has rightly developed a reputation for being a very fair host for these kinds of conversations. So, but again, as we sort of get, as modernity, as we continue to sort of get beyond modernity, the setup of Justin's show, which really rose in the heyday of sort of the atheist-theist debates, you know, Justin's really trying in some ways, I think, to pivot the program because the public conversation is really pivoting. So once John laid the groundwork, I thought this is the part that, you know, potentially could really connect with the audience.
Okay, so cultures, across cultures and across history, people have figured out this perennial problem of self-deception.
And so the first part, he talks about self-deception and all of the things that go into self-deception, and basically there's combinatorial explosion. It's very difficult for human beings to know the truth, but now truth we're going to have to, of course, contextualize within John's four P's.
Self-destructive, other-destructive, self-deceptive behavior. And what they've done is they've created a college...
Now, again, I always think of these to gain insights. I mean, part of why I do this thing is because when I listen to things even repeatedly, new insights come up. There is, I think, implicit in John's, perhaps, you know, I'm thinking about this, implicit in John's project an optimism about humanity. And I don't say that in a detrimental way, even as an Augustinian and a Calvinist, but there is self-deception, there is self-destruction, and that's very much the Augustinian, but you know, even in Augustinian anthropology is very balanced. On one hand, we are rebels, we are self-destructive, we are self-deceiving, but we are also children of God and image bearers of God. And so in I think a balanced Augustinian anthropology, there are both of these things at play. And the idea is that we, in fact, you know, we have to deal with Augustine and Pelagius. We in fact have a capacity to know things and to know the truth. The image of God is not completely obliterated from us, to use Christian terms.
Ecologies of practices, because this is a complex dynamical system. What they've done is they've created ecologies of practices. Because this is a complex dynamical system, you can't just intervene on it by, oh, I'll just start believing this, or, you know, well, yeah, do it sometime. Just that, you know, if that's all it was, we wouldn't need to go to therapy. You know?
In other words, we're not transparent to ourselves. Life isn't straightforward. We don't all just collectively, naively see what's wrong and all collectively, naively do the truth. We have humanity as we know it.
Just stop doing that. That doesn't work, right? And so we need very complex ecologies of practices in order to deal with that self-deceptive behavior.
And in many ways, world cultures and world religions and traditions of wisdom and ancient wisdom, that's the topic, ancient wisdom and the meaning crisis. Ancient wisdom was afforded to individuals and populations so that they, in fact, could be, as we might say, just in the most general of terms, we could be better people, we could have better civilizations, we could have better societies, we could do good to one another. And, you know, holding, and so this is where we sort of get into this dead reckoning. It's better not to do genocide than to do genocide, even though human beings have been genocidal all the way through human history. It's better to love than to hate. It's better to give than to receive. I mean, there's all of this wisdom that, of course, not just in Christianity, not just in Judaism, but in the Eastern religions, there's all this wisdom. And so you have these ecology of practices and communities that are all there to address self-deception, self-destruction, other destruction.
And then they need to be situated within a valorizing worldview.
Okay, when he says a valorizing worldview, that valor, it's mean a worldview that affords evaluation, a worldview that values things, such as, you know, let's preserve our life rather than take it. Let's be kind rather than hostile. I mean, there is a hierarchy, so if you want to listen to it in Petersonian terms, there's a hierarchy of values, and these communities create these hierarchy of values, and they instantiate them in moral codes, they instantiate them in practices, they instantiate them in art, they instantiate them in all sorts of things, and it takes on flesh within these communities, and these communities and participation in these communities afford wisdom, and these, in fact, are what has allowed human beings to grow populations together, establish cities with millions and millions of people, to establish civilizations that are productive and not simply self-destructive. They're never perfect, but you get a sense of progress and improvement throughout the scope of human history because of these cultures and religions and wisdom traditions and all of this. I mean, basically what he's doing here is making a very broad case for civilization.
When you have that, when you have an ecology of practices that's designed to ameliorate that foolishness, that self-deceptive, self-destructive behavior, and enhance that connectedness, that meaning in life, right? So to really try and shift so we get a much more of the connectedness and much less of the self-deceptive across in that domain general manner, and that is situated within a tradition and a community that valorizes it with a supportive worldview. That's wisdom. And here's...
So there's a definition of wisdom.
The issue, for various reasons, historical, mostly that I go in this series, our philosophical and cultural history, what has happened is we have lost a worldview that has a proper place and valorizes an ecology of practices for the cultivation of wisdom and the enhancement of meaning. So the
and he would argue that part of what has happened in our system, well, I'll let him say it, he's just going to say it.
Predominant worldview is the scientific worldview. And as a cognitive scientist, this is the problem I take as my central task in cognitive science. The scientific worldview has an explanation of everything but how science is possible. So it's got this wonderful explanation of atoms and solar systems and galaxies and even living things and blah, 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 blah. But what about the act of doing science? How do we make that meaning? How do we, because science is a process. We shouldn't confuse science with its claims. Science is a massive ecology of practices for overcoming self-deception. That's what the scientific method, I think, is properly understood.
Now it's sort of nice to compare what John here does with what Krauss does. I've had Krauss in the last few videos. Because Krauss, John's critique, on one hand, he would say, with Krauss, science is this amazing process by which we can, in fact, and I'm going to add some words here, that we can, in fact, become more aware of certain propositional truths out there in the universe. Okay, science is very propositional. But as John just said, what science can't do is account for itself. It's unable to do that. And that's where Krauss would probably, that's where Krauss doesn't really have an answer.
How is it that we are able to do this? To speak of it pictorially, we have this scientific worldview in which we, as meaning makers and as the generators of science, do not have any proper place or home. And so what you're seeing, and what you've been seeing over time, I think it sort of starts in around the 11th century. What you're seeing over time is people increasingly feeling, you know, disconnected from each other, from the world, from themselves even. And so you get a whole bunch of symptoms. We've got the rise in suicide, even suicide independent of clinical depression right now, which is a very telling sign. Loneliness epidemic, it's just, right? We have the mental health crisis, which most people are now acknowledging, depression, anxiety disorders. We have the addiction crises, the opioid crises. We have the virtual exodus, people now explicitly declaring that they prefer to live in the virtual world rather than in the real world. And I think that tells you what...
And those who are just doing it without the explicit declaration.
They're finding something in that world that's missing from the real world. But you also have what Christopher Massapietro and I call sort of positive responses. You have the mindfulness revolution. You have the revival and growth of, you know, Hellenistic wisdom philosophies like Stoicism, what motivated my original series, the attempts by the West, and it's not going great to try and import Buddhism into Western society. So, and there's a bunch of other things. I'm talking too long, but there's a whole. I tried to give you the explanation and the symptomology.
And I think actually that was a terrific way to go. Now, I think if this conversation could have gone better if Amari had, you know, 50 hours of prep so that he could have understood John, and he didn't have that, and I imagine John didn't have time to read both of Amari's books. I think they could have had an interesting conversation, especially around Aristotle. But on a show like this, it's difficult to get there. Again, part of, I think, the challenge that we're facing is I don't think people appreciated all of what went in, even to these atheist-theist debates that were going on. There was so much that both sides could sort of assume, even though there was sort of often a talking past each other. With a conversation like this, they're quite apart from each other, and so to actually be able to have them come together and talk to one another is a pretty big challenge. Okay, well, let's switch here and take a look at take a look at Amari's work. Now, as he mentioned here, he had done his first book is, in fact, sort of a spiritual memoir, From Fire by Water, My Journey to the Catholic Faith. And he spoke about that just a little bit in there. And then I want to pull out some quotes.
As you said, I was born and raised in Tehran, Iran. I moved to the U.S. when I was 13, about to turn 14. But already before I left Iran, I had declared myself an atheist because I just associated God with the God of the Ayatollahs and their, you know, judicial floggings and amputations and so forth.
Now this is key because in some ways, John Vervaeke's personal story is similar to many of the kinds of people that we're talking about in this or talking with in this little corner of the internet. Raised in a Christian home, rejected the faith by virtue of a whole variety of things. In his own words, it was not a healthy or productive little segment of Christianity that he was raised in. And of course, myself being a pastor, I know this. I find people who were raised in very dysfunctional Christian homes, and it's not at all unreasonable that they would not only when they leave the home, they would leave the faith. And John isn't making those kind of claims about his home, but this is the kind of thing. Now, here we have an individual who was raised in Iran, and I've actually, over the last few years, had the opportunity to know a few individuals who sort of fit into this, and some of them have been on my channel. You know, Persia, if you follow Tom Hollandall, I mean, Persia is one of these truly remarkable world civilizations that, in fact, has a civilizational thread and legacy that goes all the way back to antiquity. Now, of course, Islam came through, and you know, it's a very complex story, but it's one of the truly great world civilizations is Persia. And of course, what happened since the revolution, the Islamic revolution, of course, what happened before that was modernity and the Shah, and during the Cold War, the United States wanting to very much have Iran be a buffer against the growth of communism. Well, Iran didn't go communist. It went a whole new way. And I think even that part of the story is a big part of this whole story, because part of what the rise, you know, at the end of the First World War, there's this book that I mention every now and then about the storytelling of the religious aspect of the First World War. At the end of the First World War, many people believed Islam was going to simply cave in and die, but it didn't. A new force in Islam really took hold, and that's been, you know, there's a variety of ways to try and name it, but of course, Iran has been one element of resurgent Islam. The other, of course, in Saudi Arabia. So you've got the Shia and the Sunni versions of it. But so this individual is raised in Iran, and I didn't buy the whole book. I just read the sample on Kindle. And so, you know, there are elements to his story in terms of why in Iran he would, you know, have the particular story he does.
And then came to the United States, more or less took a path that isn't that exotic. I mean, I wrote a spiritual memoir before the current book about my decision to become a Roman Catholic. And, you know, it's not too exotic for a 16-year-old to read Thus Spoke Zarathustra and read Nietzsche. And
a little exotic. I know some who have done it, but it's a little exotic.
Think that he's the first one after Nietzsche to hit upon the idea that there may be no God, and therefore human beings don't have creatureliness, and therefore human nature or nature as such has no norm, and therefore you can remake the world as you please, whether in a kind of nihilistic direction, or as I, in my case, you know, briefly becoming a kind of Marxist radical. And then through a long process of reading, I came to believe, first of all, in a God, and then in a personal God, and ultimately in the God of the Bible, as I encountered in the Catholic Church. The hardest was to come to believe in a personal God.
Now, these are all really telling, again, I haven't read his memoir, but these are really telling little stopping points. And in some ways, it seems, and there's quite a bit of mention of C.S. Lewis, in some ways, it seems he sort of followed along the breadcrumbs of someone like Lewis. A little bit different, of course. Lewis stayed an Anglican. Amari went to Roman Catholicism. But there are, I mean, you could sense something of a meaning crisis in there, but it's obviously on a bigger canvas because of his coming out of Iran.
My particular path, I don't think we talked about this in our previous conversation, Justin, but my path to coming to believe that there is a God is the one that C.S. Lewis recommends, as it were, in his Mere Christianity, although I hadn't encountered it at the time. And in some ways, Immanuel Kant as well. And that's the proof by way of the conscience. That is, that there seems to be some interior voice that we all have that urges us to eschew evil and to do good. And that interior voice tends to mirror what seems to be kind of an objective order among all peoples. I mean, there are differences at the margins, but all peoples, you know, revile theft and murder and rape. And so there seems to be some objective moral order in the world, and that in its dictates mirror or reflect, you know, the conscience as we experience it, the moral conscience. And to me, ultimately, that came to be, you know, proof for the existence of a God, because if there is a moral order, then it has an author, and there seems to be this order around me, both a moral order and a natural order, that couldn't be accounted for otherwise. And I would grant, you know, the kind of you know, Richard Dawkins of the world and others that you know, that voice that I hear and call the conscience is a product of thousands of years of, you know, evolutionary development in our species, or that it's, you know, millions of synapses firing in the brain. I would grant all of those as answers to empirical how questions, but I couldn't grant them that they answer why questions, which are questions of metaphysics.
And of course, with Krauss, I played that section on how and why.
Of philosophy and also of theology proper, of revelation. And that the two needn't be in tension with each other. I mean, you can grant that empirical science answers the how questions, but it fails because it's not designed to answer ultimate questions.
So my initial read on him is he's in some ways inhabiting sort of the modernist frame in this. And I want to be very clear that I'm not saying that's a bad frame to be in. It's like all frames we have, it's got its strengths, it's got its weaknesses. But when I listen to him, and when I read some of the quotes that he had in here, I mean, it seems to illuminate the story. This is from his spiritual memoir. "I thought I was American before I ever set foot in the United States. When I first arrived at my adopted homeland, just before I turned 14, I spoke English fluently with an American accent that I had picked up from the movies. It's precisely these issues that various Islamist revolutions took place. I mean, these were some of the issues behind the attacks of 9/11, the Iranian Revolution, are because of the pervasive influence of modernity and the pervasive influence of the West all around the world, that they basically saw that modern European colonial secular culture with its cultural powerhouses and evangelistic tools like movies were pretty much conquering the hearts and minds of their people. And so in many ways, the way they chose to fight it was to put up high walls and to just take it head on. And that's very much what you have with Islamic fundamentalism. And fundamentalism is the correct word. When I talked about Christian fundamentalism before, fundamentalism is often a complete denial and a pushback of modernity And these kinds of fundamentalisms, as with Christian fundamentalism, it's simply a frontal denial of certain aspects of modernity and say, we are not accepting these propositions. We're going to maintain our propositions. And as I said before, Pentecostalism is a little bit different because Pentecostalism is a denial of modernity in other frames. So, if I suffered an exile sense of loss, I don't remember it. For while still living in the Ayatollah's Iran, I'd given myself over to the American idea. The journey across the Atlantic ratified what I already concluded in my heart. In the Western imagination, moreover, the individual matters as an individual. Again, by contrast, the emblem of the Iranian sensibility was the young boy who, during the war with Iraq, had strapped himself with grenades and dashed under the incoming enemy tank to earn his spot on giant murals around Tehran and have his story recounted on state television. The model boy had consummated his devotion to nation and regime in one irrevocable act of self-negation. Can you blame me for preferring Luke Skywalker to Indiana Jones? Now, one of the things that often Americans don't think about is American worldview tends to be very myopic and self-centered. So in the American consciousness, there was the Iranian Revolution, and we wouldn't have paid any attention to that if it hadn't been for the hostages and Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan and that whole story. And then America just sort of took Iran off the map. They were bad guys. They burned presidents in effigy. They burned American flags. And what Americans paid no attention to, which was a significant thing for the Islamic Republic, was the war with Iraq, because, and Americans especially later paid no attention to that, because Saddam was, in a sense, our guy in fighting Iran. And that Iran-Iraq war was a huge war with tremendous loss of life, and Americans, for the most part, didn't really pay much attention to it. And we were sort of, you know, the American government was sort of cheering on Saddam. Didn't really want Saddam to win, but didn't want Saddam to lose either. And so that, of course, sets up then the Iraq-Iran war ended. And, of course, Saddam invades Kuwait. And then that sets up sort of the whole other thing. And Iran has just been out there that sort of comes up in blips. And, you know, are we going to have a war with Iran? No. Or, you know, Straits of Hormuz and all these kind of things. It's very spotty in the American consciousness. But of course, if you're Iranian, the American government and American policy and all of these things are, of course, regular parts of your life. What you can see, though, in here already is that in many ways, the evangelism properties of American secular modernity was already doing what it's done, not only in the United States, not only in Europe, but all throughout the Middle East, and deeply impacted him as a child. And you can read, he goes into where his family was with respect to the revolution, and he writes about that. You can even, you know, you can pick up a lot of that just from the sample that's on Amazon. We jump forward a little bit later. Well, the Iranian way was irrational. And again, you can see he had already been formed in sort of the Western secularity, which of course would lead to his atheism at some point. But then he becomes a Catholic. I became Catholic after concluding that Catholicism is true. Now, that's really interesting. He didn't say because Catholicism worked. Now, he would say that too. But because it's true, that's a very modernist perspective. It's sort of the way that a modernist chooses their religion and their worldview. They sort of put them all out there and they decide which one is true. It's very much what C.S. Lewis did. And again, I'm not complaining about this, but what I am saying is that a majority of Americans don't choose their religion this way. After the fact, they might decide that it's true. It might be a post hoc rationalization or justification. But I would argue that most people move into a religion, find that it works, and then justify it by being true. That's much more the elephant and the rider. I became Catholic after concluding that Catholicism is true. My accidental circumstances, Muslim-born, Iranian-American, these aren't accidents because, I mean, this again, these are rather essential to the story, I would argue. How would I permit my conversion to be reduced to politics and identity? And I'm not reducing them to politics and identity. when in fact it had been sparked by the opposite idea. That is that there is such a thing as truth. Okay, again, this is a very modernistic approach to the world. That truth is eternal and universal and isn't circumscribed by politics, history, genetics, language, geography, or identity. It's almost a definition of a monarchical vision. It's, you know, truth in its essence. That's, again, this very modernistic approach to going about being a human being. Meanwhile, a few of my more secular friends wondered out loud if I wouldn't have been better off with one of the mainline Protestant denominations. Of course, because in some ways, the mainline denominations for a long time have been secularists at prayer. Okay? Now, I don't want to offend any of my mainline viewers. I'm not being disparaging, but in terms of how I'd say blue church, secular Americans look at Christianity, yeah, the mainliners are the good people. We don't really understand why they go to church. We cheer them on, and we love it when evangelicals go and become mainline, because then they start voting for the correct party, and they start holding the correct views on all sorts of social issues, and they stop fighting about evolution and abortion and these kinds of things. But that doesn't mean we're going to your church. Because why would I spend a perfectly good Sunday morning going to church when I could sleep in, have coffee with friends, go do yoga or whatever? I mean, that's the perspective. How could I reconcile my self-proclaimed classical liberalism with Rome's hard teachings on divorce, homosexuality, the ordination of women, and the like? The question lurked behind these questions, I suspect, was this. Had I found in the Catholic faith a way to express the reactionary longing of my Persian soul, albeit in a Latin key? That's a great line. And I think he's exactly right. That's probably what they were afraid of. Oh, instead of you becoming an Islamist terrorist, you're going to become just a new fundamentalist, but a really Latin fundamentalist. You're not going to be one of those guys who buys a pickup truck and puts an American flag on and votes for Donald Trump and won't get a vaccine and, you know, all these caricatures that they watch in the news. You're going to be one of those. You're going to be like the Supreme Court justices, the conservative Catholics that get on the Supreme Court. So, but again, I'm not trying to set up straw mans here. I'm just saying these are the stock players usually in the American media zeitgeist. And that being said, he approaches his faith in a very modernist frame. It's true, therefore, again, it's deductive. This is true, therefore, this will go. I am not casting aspersions on that culture or that approach to rationality. I think it's perfectly valid and legitimate, and many of you live that way. I'm just saying many, 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 many people don't think or live or work that way. It's far more intuitive. They find what works, and then they sort of justify it. The elephant cuts the path. The rider creates the talk. Now, both of these individuals are dealing with sort of dead reckoning navigation in some ways. I think that's what we all do. We're all looking for truth. And whether you grew up in Iran and, you know, by virtue of your growing up and the treatment of your family and all of those things, did not develop a taste for the Ayatollah's way to a great new world, but in fact found yourself much more attracted to the kinds of culture, the individualist modern culture that you find in America, which of course led him into atheism first and then later led him into Catholicism. John Vervaeke, of course, is a very different story that's behind it. You have truth propositionally, but then the other three P's of Vervaeke's P's come into play. Procedurally, participation, and I can never remember all four. I even wrote them down today. Skepticism about our own capacity to inhabit truthful models available will make meaning its own axis in a compass. And this is where I say most people are not going to sort of approach these problems deductively. Let's establish capital T truth and then work our way down from there. Most people are going to do it inductively. And I think in that way, meaning, they do what's meaningful and not what's expedient. Jordan Peterson's one of his 12 rules for life. They are going to approach it in terms of meaning as a compass, meaning as a gyroscope. And again, this is part of the reason I think Peterson lit a fuse under the culture, because suddenly, well, Peterson will tell you you're looking for the truth, but you're going to use meaning as a compass for finding the truth. Now, again, if you look at Krauss, meaning is sort of a fiction that's found inside your head, and you project it out onto a world of objects. And Verveke is not going to go there. He's going to say that meaning is sort of transjective. It's something that we generate between us and the world, between us and each other, in community with our experiences. And this is sort of how we go about this. Now, it's interesting, if you go back to Jordan Peterson's question and answer, when he gets this question, do you need God for a meaning in life? That's a fairly modernistic framing of the question. Peterson, of course, well, you know, what do we mean by God? Yada, yada, yada. I made a little video about this. One of the things that he talked about in there is proximal meanings. You can gain meaning by being a soccer player and kicking the ball in the goal and having the cheerleaders go up, et cetera, et cetera. You can have meaning in your hobbies. And in fact, Amari mentioned that his grandfather, after the revolution, decided he was just going to shut down his world, be involved in his little hobbies, do translations of the books because he knew, I'm not going to be around forever, not going to bother fighting this wave in Iran. I'm just going to settle down, lead a quiet life, devote myself to my hobbies, have a meaningful life doing this. But all of these proximal meanings are good, they're necessary, they're part of life, they fill up our lives. In a lot of ways, this is also sort of Krauss's approach, because he'll say, even though he'd say, no, you're projecting your meaning onto these proximal meanings, they're good enough. You can sort of fill up your life good enough. You can have an enjoyable life, you can have a fulfilling life. Fulfillment, I think, is far more a function of meaning than truth. You can have a fulfilling life and everything will be fine. Now, there's a big symptomatic undertone to John's work. And I don't mean that to dismiss it, because he very much frames this in terms of truth. John's overall project as a scientist, and now trying in some ways to not be limited by modernistic science, by recognizing not just propositional truth, but trying to integrate more fully perspectives of truth, which are, of course, part of his ecology of practices for wisdom, for, you know, cultivation of truth, because when he's talking about self-deception and self-destruction, those are very much anti-truth. But the symptomology of the meaning crisis, the emphasis is really very much on the therapeutic. And that's where he sort of ends what he puts in that little clip that I showed you. Questions that you're going to have is, how proximal is much of this truth? And underlying a great deal of modernity since Descartes and others is, of course, a deep skepticism about the degree to which we can know truth. And this sort of launches the little continual feud in this little corner of the internet about, is the universe fundamentally personal, or is it fundamentally objective, let's say? But I don't want to trigger that right now. Now, Jordan Peterson, when he talks to John Verveke, very much keeps wandering over into culture war things, and John keeps saying, I know the culture war is out there. It's not the emphasis. My emphasis is an ecology of practices so that individuals can discover self-transcendence, can do all these things. In many ways, John Verveke's goal is very similar to Jordan's goal, is that even though John isn't using these words, by the ecology of practices, John does want to help people to clean their room and order their life and limit the self-deception and limit the self-destruction and try and keep going with that. Peterson, of course, and John doesn't disagree with this, and Krauss doesn't disagree with this, nearly almost nobody disagrees with the fact that when people stop having or stop inhabiting a robust religious space, they become increasingly susceptible to ideologies that become their functional religions. And they're often not very good religions. And John, in his question and answer on my channel, I thought did a wonderful job of articulating his position with respect to that. He did some of that articulation with Jordan in their conversation. And he would agree that part of this is part of his project, because he obviously wants to give people a better platform than just becoming an advocate or a person who is just promoting their particular political agenda. Because you can find all kinds of meaning in that, but we should pause and say, why is that political activism so meaningful? And I think it's meaningful because of scale. And this, again, I think is one of the huge challenges, and John and I have talked about this, and he's mentioned it before, one of the huge challenges that his project has, because scale is an enormously difficult thing to deal with, because, you know, even for John coming on Unbelievable, he has to try to bring his argument down into a tiny little package and deploy it. Well, traditional religions have many, 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 many ways of deploying their package, at least deploying many little camel's noses, hopefully to get the rest of the camel into the tent. And we can see that in Amari's story, because he seems to, and I hope I'm not getting him wrong, but just my initial impression, he seems to, for the most part, be inhabiting a fairly modernist frame. Now, he talked about Derrida and Foucault, and in fact, there's a quote that he had with respect to those that he looked at, you know, after, and it makes perfect sense, you know, he sort of goes into his atheism via Marx and Derrida and Foucault, and eventually, I think, probably sees the shallowness of that. Again, I haven't read his memoir, and then finds a much richer ecosystem in Roman Catholicism. But again, the sort of the order of operations, let's use that mathematical language, the order of operations that he works through is very much a modernist order of operations. And again, I'm not saying it's a bad order of operations. I think it's a perfectly legitimate order of operations, but that's where it sort of sets right now in the worldview landscape. Of course, Rod Hare had, I think, I'll have to pin it, one of the best comments on the video that I released today. If there's no room for why, neither is there for why not. And that's exactly the moral problem that Krauss is going to have, because all of these moral issues are generally navigatable through the why issues and also the salience landscape, and your salience hierarchy are very much going to be determined by your why issues. That's really going to set the values of your community. That, you know, why do Roman Catholics fight so hard about abortion? Well, there's some big why issues in there. Every community, why did the Ayatollah come so down hard on America? Because America is the great Satan, because America is the Satan that is luring in Iran's young people into their way of life via media, through movies, via Baywatch was often an example cited, the Osama bin Laden days, you know, on and on and on. You are really missing the big meaning rocket engines of a fully functional worldview if your whys don't scale all the way up. Why are we here? To love God and enjoy Him forever. First question, answer of the shorter Westminster Confession. Iran used those big rockets because they had Islam, which was a fully formed worldview, a fully formed ancient religion. They could deploy it, and it could go to scale very quickly. Now, obviously not perfectly. Obviously never catches everyone. You have a defector in Amari who eventually goes to another one of the big historic ancient wisdom traditions. And, of course, John Vervaeke wants sort of a mixed martial arts of wisdom traditions. But again, it's a very challenging project. How long can you keep working from a facsimile of Christian morality? And this is where some of the big questions of the modern Western project of post-modernity really get engaged. And so when you look again at the work of, say, Tom Holland and Douglas Murray, these are the questions they have, both of whom, Tom Holland, again, increasingly inhabiting a little bit more of the Christian ecclesiastical space, Douglas Murray still standing a little bit outside, but both of them seeing the dynamics of it here and saying, how long, when the culture sheds Christianity as the global forum, will the moral the assumed moral imagination erode? And that's obviously a very big question. Can't we just keep the old systems going? Probably. And I would argue that all along the way, the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics and magisterial Protestants always continue to keep their systems running. If you look at, let's say, the American Air Force, you've got B-52s out there that are older than their pilots. Well, why? Because those B-52s, they keep retrofitting, they keep tinkering, they keep adding new electronics, they keep redesigning. So I think he's a great example of these old systems that are still going very well. But a lot of it depends on who we is. And again, what was nice about this conversation with these two stories, understanding their trajectory, at least to this point, was not difficult to see. Philosophy keeps moving beneath the surface, and we saw that with Brett Sokold's Transubstantiation book. Individuals can live meaningful lives in many systems, and this is a point that John Vervaeke keeps bringing up, that when they do, for example, psychological studies on religious traditions, many, many religious traditions continue to effectively provide meaning and a sense of well-being and community and a lot of this wisdom making for the individuals. Now, this is where, you know, we've got, say, Jonathan Peugeot and me and John Vervaeke. I mean, Peugeot and I are both sort of on the Christian side, if we're going to divide the line that way. But I'm sort of on the Vervaeke side when it comes to, I think, the taking away of what's happening in our culture means that it's very difficult for some people like John Vervaeke, like Tom Holland, like Douglas Murray to inhabit some of the old systems. Now, many of you have gone in to inhabit some of those old systems. And again, I congratulate you. I cheer you on. I encourage you. I support you. But I also think even if you say, our B-52 is as pristine as it was when it rolled off the assembly line in 1956. And I say, I don't think it's just that. I think your tradition has been updating and accommodating and figuring out a way to keep that old aircraft in the sky and to keep it effective and to keep it from falling into obsolescence. Now, again, via the Lindy effect, old worldviews can do this. Islam rebounded amazingly in the 20th century. It's a pretty remarkable thing. Transformation that happened within Islam. Is it a positive one from my point of view? No, but it's still pretty amazing. Because these old systems, I mean, the systems have to be multi-personal. If you have big picture ranges, they will tend to afford that much more of the totalizing, scaling worldview possibilities for the individual. And I got to get off this because I have a Zoom call right now. But we want systems that scale. They need to scale across IQ. They need to scale across cultures. They need to scale from individual to small group community to bigger community to city, nation, state, country, world, forever. They need to scale that large. And I think for the welfare of the world, a pluralistic world, they need to be at least as devoted to the welfare of the out-group as the in-group. And again, you know, no mystery here. I think Christianity does all this. But I think these are the requirements for addressing the meaning crisis and what we need. And again, I think the ancient modern is really critical because of, as Nassim Taleb notes, the Lindy effect. So, all right, I've got to end this video and get on a Zoom call. So thanks for watching and leave a comment.